Welcome. The deep state has its hands in everything, and I was in the middle of it for decades. When I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program, the deep state turned on me. It ruined my life, took away my rights, threw me in prison, but they didn't break me. I fought back, and I still do. I'm John Kiriakou. On my show, The Deep State, I take you behind the geopolitical moves, the color revolutions, behind the politics and the politicians. We shine a light on where the deep state is hiding. I want to bring on now Natalie and Clayton Morris, hosts of the hit YouTube show Redacted. Turning to Tucker Carlson. You were on Tucker Carlson just a few days ago, Clayton. I've been on a couple of times. I think I'm going to go back on in the next 4 or 5 weeks. I like Tucker very much. I consider him to be a friend. And I have to tell you, I'm genuinely worried for his safety. Tucker is one of those rare truth tellers. He speaks whatever happens to be on his mind, but it's always very well thought out. He's not afraid to call important people on the carpet for things that they've said or done. In the current political climate, in the post, let's call it the post-Charlie Kirk era, do you think Tucker Carlson has reason to be worried?
I think he wouldn't admit that. He doesn't like to, he never likes to have the focus be on him
never.
At all.
That's right.
I've known him for years, and he's never like me, like
never.
Navel gazing. He hates that. He hates that with a passion, you know. I need a large security contingent because I'm so important. Like, he's not that kind of person at all. But look, the SBU tried to kill him, almost blew up his car when he went to Moscow. Like there's some realities here. You have these nut job, you know, MAGA influencers, these sort of pro-Israel Zionists who are basically actively calling for him to be arrested, attacked. And they have platforms. I mean, they're literally not thrown off of X. They're calling for like the arrest and hurting of his family, and they're still somehow on X, and they still have jobs at like Fox News somehow. Like, when I worked at Fox News, if I would have called for like the death of a human being, like, I would have been fired. But this is a new era, so you can call for, you know, attacks on certain people like that. And I think, you know, he's doing what he needs to do to protect himself, and I'm sure he's got a wife. His wife is probably wanting to make sure he's safe and protected, and he's got people around him who are saying, hey, Tucker, I know you don't like this to be about yourself, but we're going to protect you. So, but I don't want to speak out of turn for what's going on behind the scenes. But, yeah, he is a truth teller, and of course that's a small that's a commodity these days. It's hard to find those.
Why is it that there are so few people, whether they're on the political left or the political right in the United States, who are unwilling to tell the truth about the situation on the ground in Israel and Palestine? And more specifically, what I mean is that Tucker had, for example, Mother Agapia, George Stephanopoulos' sister, who's a Greek Orthodox nun. She has lived in the West Bank or in East Jerusalem for decades. And she gave a very long conversation with Tucker about what life is like for Christians in Israel. It's extremely difficult. Tucker then went to Israel and interviewed Ambassador Mike Huckabee. In my estimation, that interview was a disaster, an unmitigated disaster for Huckabee. He was unable to answer Tucker's questions. And when he did answer Tucker's questions, he essentially turned the entire Middle East against the United States, saying that God promised Israel to the Jews. Israel means everything from the Euphrates River to the Nile, which is essentially the entire Middle East, and they can go ahead and take it, he said. He didn't care. So first of all, how much damage do you think that does? But secondly, and I want to ask both of you your opinions, but secondly, why is this the prevailing position among American Christians when it was Palestinian Christians who were the original Christians And they get no love from American Christians.
Yeah, this is something that I've been pretty obsessed with in the last 2 years. Because I, you know, I was inspired by the rise of Christianity, the popularity of Christianity around the Trump election, because it seemed like there were some conservative values that were revalidated in the election of Donald Trump. And I thought what that meant was sort of family values, you know, sort of, I don't know, a refutation of some of the sexual perversions that was so popular during the Biden years. And then for this group to turn around and support a genocide and right. support a terrorist government, I was confused by. And so I went back to where this began. I recently finished the Canfield book called Schofield and His Amazing Book or something like that. It's a tough read, but it tells the story of the Schofield Bible, which is the informant text of evangelicals. And I thought, why? Why do they do this? Where did it come from? It turns out that Cyrus Schofield himself was a bit of a scoundrel. He was a Confederate war soldier. He was the district attorney in Kansas. He had lied about his Confederate service to the army. He defected from there as well. He says he's from Tennessee. He's not. He's from Michigan. He had two daughters and a Catholic wife who he left penniless, even though he became quite rich. And then before he did that, he was sued several times for fraud. He just was a scoundrel. And then all of a sudden, Christian conversion, and he's a star, a rising star in the Christian movement. This is around early 1900s. He moves to Massachusetts. He becomes a part of this Niagara Falls Convention. And in the late 1800s, there was this appetite for end-of-the-world theology because the world was hard back then. And he joins this movement and somehow becomes a member of the Lotos Club in New York City. The Lotos Club is a club of Wall Street bankers and early Zionists. They're the ones who fund the Schofield Bible. They see in him the snake oil salesman they need. They fund this movement, and then this nobody, this guy who'd been a scoundrel his whole life, is now this popular theologian, popular priest, a religious leader who never had, and all of a sudden this book is just everywhere. Why? How did that happen? Well, do evangelicals know that it's Wall Street-backed, that it was the brainchild of Wall Street and early Zionists? I don't think they do. And so their allegiance to this comes from a pretty rotten place, and I don't think they know it.
Well, there are evangelicals that we know that have broken free of this mm-hmm. and had educated themselves on this, mm-hmm. and that's why they want to suppress this story, because if more evangelicals learn about this, if you go to Texas, for instance, and you know, to go to any of those churches and you were to educate them on this, they would cast you out. So they don't want you to know that this entire line of Christianity has, you know, right. been co-opted by like a scoundrel and a...
And Schofield's original churches were in Dallas. So, you know, that was born of that movement. And then it just grew. It was Texas and then the Northeast.
But we have friends who broken out of this, you know, educated themselves. And once they realize like that this whole, their whole movement has been, is a canard in many ways, backed by this scoundrel and like this fake version of the Bible in many ways, backed by Wall Street Zionists, they're like outraged by it and they become non-denominational.
Right.
They're kind of wandering around the desert, like looking for a new church because they can't believe that their whole 20, 30 years of being raised in that environment was a lie.
It was a lie. Ways. You know, years I was an adjunct professor of intelligence studies at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, which is the largest evangelical university in the world. And when they first approached me with this job offer, I said, "Are you sure you want me? You and I probably disagree on 95% of the issues. Why would you want me to be a professor?" And without missing a beat, the dean of the Jesse Helms School of Government said, "Because torture's not Christian." And I said, "You know what? I'll take the job." And so I wow. really, really enjoyed my time at Liberty. But we clashed constantly over this issue of Middle Eastern Christians. I would take them to task every single time. I would hear them say something about sending a delegation to convert people to Christianity in Palestine. And I said, this is where Christianity began. You guys are snuffing out Palestinian Christians. There was one student that I had who told me that she was going on a mission. And I said, oh, that's great. What are you going to do? Well, I'm gonna bring people to Christ. I said, cool, where are you going? And she said, Macedonia. I said, but they're already Christians in Macedonia. they're Orthodox, like me.
Well, look at Iran. What's the plan for Iran?
But they don't consider it their type of Christian.
No.
It's almost as if they're savage type. Like, yes, but we really understand it, and they don't. And so we are going to... I'm sorry I interrupted you, but let me just finish this point. Their theology is fundamentally conflicting.
Yes.
Because evangelicals want eventually for all the Jews that they support to convert to Christianity.
And
the Jews absolutely
line.
Do not want that.
No.
They want this war to bring about the coming of their Messiah, and they will remain Jews. So they have two very different end goals. They're just kind of, you know, merged right now on the war and what it will affect. And it's like, let's not talk about what happens after the rapture. I think you're coming to me. You think you're going to you. We'll just run along. Let's just have
rapture,
our little war.
The rapture being a late 19th century American evangelical invention, by the way.
Yes. Yes, again, coming out of this Niagara Falls, if you study the late 1800 movement, and, you know, out of that was born Jehovah's Witnesses, which I was raised one, and yes, and evangelicals, and this, like, end of times type theology, which I don't think you understand how much power that hands the government. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say the savages thing is really important. Like this idea that if you're at a Dallas, like, megachurch, that you're somehow more civilized than these Christians who've grown up in the Holy Land. Also, what's going to happen to the nearly 1 million Christians that live in Iran?
Are we
in any way discerning when we're carpet bombing Tehran how many of those were killing? And how many Christian churches are throughout Iran, by the way? I mean, I don't know the number. Maybe you have a better number on it, but there are many.
Many.
And nearly, I think, a million Christians that live in Iran.
And many of the churches,
we'll prioritize them.
Many of the churches go back more than 1,000 years.
Right.
There's a long history of Christianity in Iran. That's just ignored. It's just ignored today. You know,
I'm just so struck. We're not allowed to talk about the Christians being killed in Syria. We're not allowed to talk about the Christians being killed in Gaza. For some reason, if you bring it up, then you're an anti-Semite, which I just can't wrap my head around that reasoning. Like, we're not allowed to talk about your carpet bombing of Gaza is killing a lot of Christians or displacing a lot of Christians, or, you know, what's happening in Syria. We can't talk about that. The beheading of Christians. We can't. You're an anti-Semite if you bring that up, and it's infuriating.
I have to tell you a little story, and it's apropos of Syria and the situation in Syria, but it's not going to sound like it. So when my two eldest sons were little, they loved wrestling, fake wrestling, right? World Wrestling Entertainment wrestling. And so I splurged one weekend, and I bought us tickets to see wrestling at Madison Square Garden. So we go, and we're watching these guys smash chairs over each other's heads and jump and land on tables and smash the table. And I said to my eldest son, who, I mean, now he's 33, but at the time he was, I guess, 9 or 8 years old. I said, buddy, I don't get it. Which one is the good guy? And he said, that's just it, Dad. There is no good guy. That was the situation in Syria. It's possible to just have a situation where there is no good guy. And so what you do is you support the least bad guy. Bashar al-Assad had a lot of problems, right? He was a dictator. He was the son of a dictator. He used a heavy hand against his own people. But he was the only thing standing between the Christian community of Syria and complete annihilation. And so we decided we didn't like his politics, and we worked with the Israelis and the Turks to throw him out. And now he's in exile. So who takes over Syria, but the former deputy leader of ISIS, who apparently was chosen by the CIA, leads me to believe he was probably a CIA, paid CIA agent, but that's, we can talk about that at some other point. And there's a genocide against Christians. So why the short-sighted policies coming out of the United States? If we're supposed to be so Christian, so pro-Christian, we talk about Judeo-Christian values, and then we support the wholesale slaughter of the world's original Christians, I'm just not understanding, you know, where the disconnect comes from. When we come back, we will have more with the hosts of Redacted. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Stay right there. We're joined back again today by our guests, Natalie and Clayton Morris. They're the hosts of the hit show Redacted. There's a video that's going around on TikTok and other platforms right now. It's a young woman who's an American evangelical Christian, and she goes to Israel for the very first time. And she starts saying things like, you know, Israel, Israel. And a group of young Jewish boys walks up to her and they spit right on her, spit right in her face. And she wipes it off and she says, holy spit, Israel spit, it's holy, it's okay. And then she goes into the old city, and she's got a microphone, and she's trying to interview people about, you know, isn't Israel great? Over to you. And a teenager takes a backpack and just smashes her in the head with the backpack. And she starts crying. She's like, why are they doing this to me? I love Israel. Why? Why are they doing this? It's like, lady, don't you get it? They don't care about you. They only care about them. There's no room for you in Israel.
It's like a form of Stockholm syndrome in a way.
That's exactly what
it is. You know, it's like you can just continue to beat us down and we're just going to continue to kiss your ass. We'll continue to do your bidding. You can send your prime minister to our to Washington, D.C. for the seventh time. We'll take your money. We'll do everything. You can buy our American businesses. You can take over TikTok. We'll hand that to you. And then when we go there and you'll treat us like garbage, but it's okay. You're allowed to treat us like garbage. That's fine. Just keep treating us like garbage and we'll just continue to take it. At some point, someone's going to snap.
Yeah,
that's right. You know, I have to ask you about that too. About sort of taking over. Why is it, do you think, that a country as small as Israel is able to exert such outsized influence, not just in politics, we've had that conversation a thousand times, not just in American politics, but in American business, in entertainment, in banking, even in the defense industries. You know, we either give or sell Israel anything it wants. Anything at all. And the Israelis have very close and abiding relations with most of the major American defense contractors. Why?
I mean, this is something that's plagued me. And I've, you know, if you go back and read John Mearsheimer's The Israel Lobby.
Yes.
And you at least try to understand how over decades this grew and grew and grew. And there were politicians like John F. Kennedy, for instance, who certainly didn't want this and were kind of openly against it. They wind up dead, of course. So I think I don't know. I think the money, you mean follow the money at the heart of it, right? Follow the money and the influence inside of Washington and realize that almost every politician in Washington, to Thomas Massey's credit, when he admitted that everyone has like an AIPAC handler, someone who funnels money to them, make sure that they're on message. And then when you realize then that the defense industry has factories, manufacturing.
Yes.
One thing I learned years ago, and I think it's grown tremendously since I learned it, but the idea that a lot of the defense manufacturing sits in the backyard. They very strategically built little weapons parts factories in different parts of the country. So Boeing doesn't just have their main Boeing operations center, but they have, like, you know, this little piece that's built over here, and they build it in the back of. So they've spread themselves all across the United States so that they're essentially in the backyards of almost every politician.
That's right.
So that every politician can say, you know, Boeing's in my backyard. I've got to protect them. It benefits the weapons industry, but it also represents my district. Well, how many districts? Because they've spread themselves, Honeywell, Northrop Grumman, all of these, like, little divisions all across the United States. So that's one big piece of it. And then every member of Congress takes money and influence and works with AIPAC. So the money flows in and it flows right back out. And it's all one big money laundering operation. And they're all benefiting from it. And there are very few who aren't benefiting from it. And if they aren't, then they're cast out. I mean, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, or, you know, Matt Gaetz, or Congressman Thomas Massie. Look the hell that he's going through right now, being, you know, trying to be primaried. So I think it's a massive money laundering operation at the heart of it. That's how I see it, and it just flows back. So just follow the money, follow the weapons.
And I have
I
to
also
tell you,
think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Oh, go ahead, Natalie.
Go ahead. Please.
No, please.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I learned recently that it's even deeper than just that. I have a friend who got a call from a Texas state senator, and he said, "Hey, we'd like to do a state Senate resolution naming such and such a date as John Smith Day." He said, "It's pro forma. We do about 140 of these a year, where you're going to get a proclamation with the big seal of Texas and the governor's signature, and it's going to be, you know, your day." He said, "Oh, great, okay." So a couple of weeks pass, and this state senator calls back, and he says, "Listen, that John Smith Day, that's not going to happen." And he said, "Why? You said it was pro forma." And the state senator said, "The AIPAC lobbyist objected to it." And I said, "Wait a minute, they have AIPAC lobbyists in the state capitals for the state legislatures?" And he said, "Not just in the state capitals. They have lobbyists all over America. They're lobbying in local city council elections. Maybe you're running for the water board of whatever city, or the garbage commission of whatever city you happen to be living in. And there are AIPAC lobbyists, even at that level."
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. I'm not surprised, though, at all. I mean, wow. You know, you can see that's where real politics is born, right? At the local level, at the school board level, you know, that's right. in your mayoral races. That's the influence. That's how, for instance, we're in the state of Colorado. Like, everyone should read how the state of Colorado went from being a red state to a blue state. And it was all done specifically at the local level and with the ad spend, the targeted ad spend in these specific races. And now, you know, Colorado is by all accounts a blue state. On election night, it immediately, as soon as they called it, "Hey, Colorado polls are closed," they immediately called it. For Kamala Harris. You know, it's unbelievable. In a landslide election for Trump, Colorado went blue, but it all happened in the local elections.
Yeah. You know, when you study, if I were to submit a term paper about this, the hypothesis would be that the sort of communist Zionist infiltration of the U.S. government happened very early. When you study the movement that became McCarthyism, McCarthy was right. There were Soviet communist spies working inside the State Department. He did not make that up.
Right.
He got that from a State Department report that you cannot find on national archives, and he was excoriated from it, even though the FBI had corroborating files. Hoover hung him out to dry, but Hoover himself had been taking this to the White House, and it had been ignored. Why this communist infiltration? And then you look at, there's a book called The Iron Curtain Over America by John Beatty, who was a State Department representative. He worked for the State Department, and he was warning that a lot of these communists in the 50s, and who also were Zionists, mm-hmm. were converting to Judaism in order to make this claim that related to Zionism. And he said that he compared it to someone converting to a Native American religion and saying that gives me claim to the United States. It doesn't, right? And so it has, and so if I were, again, like I would need a little bit more time to flesh out this term paper, but I think that I can trace it through early American politics, and it's a long game. And I think we're seeing the fruits of it because it's such a long game. And, you know, it's brilliant, if not destructive.
Natalie and Clayton, thanks very much for being with us today. And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.